This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. American cardinals are meeting in Rome to discuss the sex abuse scandals that have rocked the American Catholic Church. 12 of the 13 U.S. cardinals are in Rome, as well as two top officials of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Addressing the cardinals today, Pope John Paul II made his strongest statement yet on the sex abuse scandal. He said, "The abuse which has caused this crisis is by every standard wrong and rightly considered a crime by society. It is also an appalling sin in the eyes of God. To the victims and their families, wherever they may be, I express my profound sense of solidarity and concern." My guest today is John Allen, who is in Rome covering this historic meeting. John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He also writes a regular column called The Word from Rome. I spoke with him earlier today. Let's start with what's happening right now. You've been to a briefing. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is the American cardinals and the chief executive officers of the American Bishops' Conference are locked in a room with the most senior officials of the Curia, that's the Pope's bureaucracy in the Vatican, and they are desperately trying to hammer out an agreement on sort of certain core matters of how you handle accusations of sexual abuse against priests, because the subtext to today is what's going to happen in June in Dallas when the U.S. bishops meet. They're going to adopt some pretty tough, by all measures, some pretty tough new policies. And the fear here is that if the Vatican and the U.S. bishops are not on the same page, then the U.S. bishops in June could adopt these new policies to great acclaim and fanfare in the American media, and then they would come over to Rome and get rejected. And I think everyone on all sides recognizes that that would be a public relations Chernobyl. And so the effort here is to try to make sure that everyone is singing out of the same songbook ahead of that June meeting.
So I heard there has been already some kind of statement today.
Yeah. There were actually two things. That the Pope made an address to the cardinals and the Curia officials this morning, in which he once again confirmed how heartsick the scandals have made him, how determined the Church is to be sure that people are not put in positions again where they can be abused. But at the same token, he reaffirmed the sort of traditional Christian, the notion of Christian conversion, which seemed to suggest that although there need to be tough policies for priests when they're found guilty of wrongdoing, that that the Church in some sense wants to leave open the possibility that they can be salvaged in some way. I know one American cardinal thought it was quite important that the Pope, in the course of his statement, used the word crime, referring to the sexual abuse crisis as a criminal problem. And of course, this is a hurdle the Church has struggled to get over. I mean, it has in the past treated this as a spiritual problem that could be dealt with behind closed doors, rather than as a legal problem that needed to involve the criminal justice system. And so I know some observers thought that was a step forward. The other thing we've had today is a briefing involving Bishop Wilton Gregory, who is the president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference, and Cardinal Francis George, who is obviously one of the American cardinals and has a reputation for being probably the brainiest of the American cardinals. And these two guys came out and talked to us after the morning session of meetings, and I think what was especially striking about their remarks were the unusually, and I have to say, as someone who follows the Vatican day in and day out, I mean, the very unusually candid, open, and honest nature of their comments. Bishop Gregory was asked about the debate over homosexuality in the priesthood, and he admitted without flinching that there are certain seminaries in the United States that have an overwhelmingly gay population and that sometimes heterosexual candidates actually feel uncomfortable. Now, this is something that if you've been following the Catholic scene for years, I mean, everyone knows, but it's sort of been taboo to say that in public. I mean, I know a priest, Father Donald Cousins, who wrote a book a few years ago called The Changing Face of the Priesthood, in which he said this very thing. And was sort of demonized in many quarters of the Church for saying it. And now you have the president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference putting it on record. I think that's remarkable. And then Cardinal George acknowledging very frankly today that there is a very serious disagreement within the Vatican and between certain U.S. bishops in the Vatican over the proposal for a one-strike-and-you're-out policy. That is, that if a priest abuses anyone once, that ought to be it, and he should be removed from ministry and ultimately defrocked. Some people want that policy. Other people have problems with it. You know, how these things are going to get resolved, we don't know. But I think the remarkable thing is how honestly disagreement and the existence of these problems are being voiced today.
You were mentioning that there was a very amazing candor that you saw today. And one of the things that I think Americans sense is that the Vatican has a very different sense of media, public relations, time. You know, they're not on the internet all the time with us looking at every story. They seem very distant, and sometimes that comes across as almost seeming contemptuous. Is that a misperception?
Well, I think it can be. I mean, I think this is an institution. I mean, the motto around the Vatican is "We think in centuries," you know, which means that they're trying not to think exclusively or be have their reactions dictated exclusively by today's controversy, but think in a sort of unhurried and reflective way about what the long-term consequences of something might be. Now, that can make for great wisdom, because sometimes the smartest thing to do in a crisis is to wait and see how it develops. But on the other hand, it also makes them very slow to respond sometimes to things that really do need a sort of urgent response. And I think that's probably what's happened in this case. I think the Vatican was slow to realize the depth and gravity of the crisis in the American church. But I do think that they have come around by and large, and I would frankly read this week's summit as an indication of that. I mean, the Pope, if he had wanted to, could have called the American cardinals over quietly. They could have flown below radar, but they chose to do this in a sort of dramatic, high-profile, last-minute way, bringing all of the American press with them. And I think in part that was an attempt to communicate to the American church, we get it, we understand. When the Vatican looks at this crisis in the American church, what they see is one part genuine scandal, the sexual abuse of minors, of course, everyone in the Vatican regards as indefensible. And frankly, I have not met any senior Vatican official that in a quiet moment wouldn't acknowledge that certain American bishops, for example, Cardinal Bernard Law of Boston, have made serious mistakes in judgment. But they also think that part of what's going on here is an artificial atmosphere of crisis that has been generated by a couple of factors that are unique to the United States. One is a very aggressive American press that they think in some ways is anti-Catholic. Another is a very well-organized sort of left wing of the American Catholic Church that the Vatican would perceive as taking advantage of this crisis to grind its particular axis, whether it has to do with clerical celibacy or the ordination of women or whatever. And they also see a certain financial hustle at stake. That is, they see, we now have a legal subspecialty having to do with clerical sexual abuse. And it's because that the Catholic Church has some deep pockets that these kind of accusations can tap. So, when the Vatican looks in on the American situation, what they see, as I say, is one part a genuine pastoral emergency, one part a atmosphere of hysteria that they think has been fed by some factors they're very hesitant to capitulate to. And I think what that means is that to date their reactions have been pretty half-hearted, pretty mixed, pretty defensive. I think that can come across sometimes as contempt, but I don't think that's the best way of reading it. I think it's more, on the one hand, they're reacting as pastors who are concerned for people who are hurting. On the other hand, they're reacting as CEOs who are worried about their institution that they see is under siege.
What's going to happen to Cardinal Bernard Law? A number of cardinals have been pushing for his resignation. As I understand, he made a statement in Rome today. What do you see as the outcome of his personal situation?
I certainly don't think that at the end of this two-day session we're going to have a resignation from Cardinal Law. For one thing, because he has said clearly to his people in Boston that he intends to stay on, and I certainly don't think he would have made that kind of statement if he had not cleared his signals from Rome. And if you look at his situation from the Vatican's point of view, I haven't met anyone in the Vatican who would defend what Law did in either the Gagan case or the Shanley case. I mean, they would certainly acknowledge there have been serious mistakes in judgment, but they would put that in the context of what they see as several decades of loyal service. Also, there's a realpolitik point here, which is the Vatican is worried about a domino effect. I mean, if Cardinal Law were to resign, then, you know, those other men who are now bishops, who were his aides, whose signatures are on many of the same documents as Cardinal Law's, you know, by strict logic, you know, they should have to resign too. And then attention would shift pretty quickly to Cardinal Egan, who has many of the same problems. You know, before very long, you could have a fairly large chunk of the American episcopacy wiped out. And certainly from the Vatican's point of view, that's not a good place to be. So, you know, I think that at the moment, the sense still is that the Law can weather the storm. The Vatican would certainly like to see him weather the storm. I don't anticipate any action against him immediately. Whether in the end it's going to prove possible for him to govern this archdiocese, whether he can continue, I think remains to be seen.
Now, until recently, the Vatican has seen this abuse scandal, as you said, sort of as an American problem. You've talked about our litigious society, our investigative journalism being very different. And I think the Vatican long saw it not only as an American problem, but an Anglo problem. But we now have incidents in France. There were 30 people accused since 1995. Uh-huh. We have incidents in Austria and Poland and Nigeria and Germany, in other places. Do you think that this is no longer going to be such an Anglo problem, or simply that now there's going to be more reporting of it elsewhere as there was in America?
Yeah, I think, you know, to be fair, I don't know many people in the Vatican that think sexual abuse is an American problem, precisely because of the examples that you mentioned. I mean, you know, my newspaper broke a story that which I was one of the – I had shared the byline in this story about the sexual abuse of women religious, that is nuns in Africa and elsewhere by priests a year or so ago. This is a problem the Vatican has acknowledged, and that it's a congregation for religious in cooperation with men's and women's religious communities has been working on ever since. What the Vatican sees as an American, or perhaps, as you say, more accurately, an Anglo-Saxon problem, is the very aggressive media response, which they see as, to some extent, exaggerated and fed along by things like the culture of the scoop and scandal in the American press, by a resentment of the very strong positions that the Catholic Church has taken on issues like abortion and birth control and so forth, and by by Anglo-Saxon tort law, which makes it easy to hold the Church corporately liable for the misconduct of its priests. That's, I think, what they diagnose as an Anglo-Saxon problem. But, you know, are we rapidly moving into a situation in which the public discussion and the push for accountability is spilling over the borders of the Anglo-Saxon world into the rest of the world? I think no question. I mean, if you look at the reaction to the case of Archbishop Julius Petz in Poland, this is an archbishop who recently resigned under the weight of accusations of sexual misconduct, which it's important for us to say that he continues to deny them. But nevertheless, he resigned. This really shattered a taboo in Polish society and I think produced a real sea change. And I think it's entirely realistic to expect that now you will have other cases like that one discussed in Poland. And I think the same thing will be happening other places. So in a way, I think what you're getting in Anglo-Saxon and especially American culture today is a preview of the kinds of stories the rest of the Catholic world will be grappling with in the years to come.
My guest is John Allen. He is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He's currently in Rome covering the meeting between Pope John Paul II and the American cardinals. We'll talk more with John Allen after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Allen. He's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book, soon to be released, is called Conclave: The Politics, Personalities, and Process of the Next Papal Elections. You've been touring the country and speaking to Catholics in different parts of the United States. What did you hear?
Well, I think the most important observation I can offer you is this, that I really think that this story has shifted on the ground in the American Catholic Church over the last few weeks. I think this started out as a sexual abuse story. I think it has become an accountability story. And what I mean is that certainly American Catholics are outraged by the revelations that we have seen about the Gagin case in Boston, the abuse of children, the Shanley case also in Boston. You know, I mean, those sorts of things are indefensible, and they would horrify anyone who cares to read the case files. But, you know, I also think Catholics are realistic enough to recognize that priests being people, some priests, like some people, are going to do abominable things. I think what really has Catholics outraged at the moment is the broader question of the way their bishops have responded to that misconduct. I mean, it's the moving abuser priest from assignment to assignment. It's paying hush money in the form of to settle civil litigation. It's the use of retaliatory litigation to intimidate victims from coming forward. It's all of that that Catholics have drawn the conclusion that their managers, their leaders, have failed them. Not all, but certainly a number. And that has a lot of Catholics asking some very basic questions about to whom are their leaders accountable? And is it enough for bishops to be accountable only to Rome? Or isn't it also important that they be accountable to the local churches that they serve? Which in turn generates other questions, like how do you get bishops in the first place? And why don't local churches play a greater role in picking them? And why can't lay people play a much more profound role in making decisions about finance and governance and personnel? All of these things that don't touch upon doctrine, but touch upon how the church is run. And so I think that's the sea change that's going on in the American Catholic Church at the moment. And I think that conversation is only beginning.
So you're saying that people want democratization, more lay power, and in some sense that's a more possible avenue of change than asking for a change of doctrine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I would use the word democratization because that's a word that you know is a very explosive word because the Vatican will always say the church is not a democracy. American bishops will say the church is not a democracy, and of course it's true. I mean, nobody is talking about, you know, getting together in a room and voting on a 50% plus one basis, you know, whether we believe in the resurrection anymore. I mean, that's a model that doesn't make sense for the Catholic Church. But I do think, you know, probably the better word for it is accountability and perhaps also lay empowerment. I mean, how do you bring laity into a situation so that bishops are accountable to them? And you're right. That's, in a way, it's an easier thing to fix than some of the other questions that people have connected to this sex abuse crisis. I mean, for example, some commentators in the American press have suggested that if the Catholic Church were to ordain women, you know, you would have a more sort of balanced, you know, base of clergy, a larger pool of people from whom to draw, and it would make it easier to screen out potential abusers. You know, that very well may be true, but there is a real theological obstacle to the ordination of women. I mean, this pontificate, that is the John Paul II, has published documents that insist that the ban on women's ordination is all but infallible, meaning unreformable. So, you know, you have to jump through some very serious doctrinal hoops before you can get to a place where you can talk about women's ordination. On the other hand, you know, bringing laity back into the governance of the church really does nothing more than take the church back to its roots. I mean, in the early centuries of the church and really on into very recent times. The first bishop of the United States, for example, John Carroll, was elected by the clergy of his diocese and of the United States, and that choice was simply ratified in Rome as late as 1829 when Pope Leo XII died. There were 646 Catholic bishops outside the Papal States, which is the region of Italy the Pope ruled as a secular monarch. Of those 646, only 24 had been appointed directly by the Pope. The rest had all been picked either by a secular government or by the people of the local community. So there is no doctrinal obstacle to raising this question of who are bishops accountable to. And so in a way, it's an easier problem to fix.
In America, there's a lot of talk about the Catholic Church and the culture of celibacy and that as a problem. That the whole question of the Church's teaching on sexuality is at issue here. Is it?
Well, I mean, from a certain point of view, of course it is. I mean, you know, sexuality is, you know, one of the most central, if not the most central aspect of human existence, and I suppose the church is always going to be working on getting its teaching exactly right. And I think one of the fascinating things, just in terms of the politics of this, is that on the sexual questions, my experience in talking to Catholics these days is that the same divisions that existed before this present crisis still exist. That is to say, the sort of liberal wing of the American Catholic Church still would like to make celibacy optional, would like to reopen the question of, gay rights, for example, would push for a revision of the teaching on birth control. And conservatives would tend to take opposite positions on all of those questions. In other words, those continue to be divisive issues. And this crisis, if anything, has simply strengthened people in their pre-existing convictions. On the other hand, on the governance question, on the accountability question, what I find is this is now an issue that is uniting people from left, right, and center. And so where it used to be sort of conservative clergy and conservative Catholics versus liberal clergy and liberal Catholics on sexual issues, I think a new fault line that we have today is between laity of all ideological stripes demanding much greater roles in governance from their clerical leaders. And so in that sense, I think the crisis is really reconfiguring the politics of the American Catholic Church in a very fascinating way.
John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book, to be released in June, is called Conclave: The Politics, Personalities, and Process of the Next Papal Election. We'll talk more with John Allen in the second half of the show. I'm Margot Adler. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Margot Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's return to our discussion with John Allen. He's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He's in Rome covering the meeting between the Pope and the American Catholic Cardinals. He's also the author of a soon-to-be-released book, Conclave: The Politics, Personalities, and Process of the Next Papal Election. We spoke to him earlier today. Various states, John, are passing laws, various states in the United States, that force the church to report sex abusers.
Right.
Rhode Island passed a law that says a priest has to report what he hears in the confessional. I found myself, perhaps because I'm 56 years old, I found myself shocked by that. I still tend to think about priests and therapists as people who have, the power of total confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
Are we witnessing a change that's going to make the trust of the confessional a thing of the past?
No, I don't think so. I think certainly the leadership of the church will fight that sort of thing, to the last drop of energy that they've got. And I think the sort of case law is fairly solidly on the church's side. So I don't see the seal of the confessional being in play here. On the other hand, the broader question of whether or not bishops ought to be what's called an automatic reporter, that is, that they ought to, as a matter of policy, be obliged to report to the police any credible evidence of criminal misconduct against a priest that comes to them outside the seal of confessional. I think that question is very much an unsettled one. There's an enormous clamor for it in the American press. On the other hand, the Vatican has very serious reservations, or at least over the years has had very serious reservations. For a couple of reasons. One is that they like to think of the relationship between a bishop and his priest as sort of a father and son. And the notion is that if a priest knows that if he confides in a bishop that he's done something wrong, and that bishop is then obligated to call the police, the priest is much less likely to confide in the first place, and therefore that it would compromise this relationship of trust that ought to exist. Also, the Vatican believes that there probably are some victims and their families that would prefer to work these things out, quietly, confidentially, with the church without involving the police. And if you have an automatic reporter policy, then in a way you take that discretion away from the bishop. So I don't see the seal of confessional being in any serious jeopardy. I do see this question of what the bishop should be obligated to report versus what's going to be in his discretion to report. That's very much a live issue, and I don't think we know yet how it's going to be resolved.
More broadly, do you see a conflict between just the whole notion of forgiveness of sins and accountability?
Yeah, this is a tough one, and I think you saw this in the Pope's address today. I mean, the Pope said, we need to have tough policies, and we need to be sure that someone who has been an abuser is never put in a position where they can abuse again. But on the other hand, really in the same paragraph, he said, we can't lose sight of the notion of Christian conversion, of repentance. This is the problem. Zero tolerance policies are not a good fit for a church that has, the sacramental understanding of sin and redemption, the notion that no matter what you've done, no matter how awful it is, you can make a fresh start. I mean, you can be contrite. You can ask for forgiveness, and having received it, then you can begin again. And I think the church is still struggling with that. And I think it, what is happening at the moment is that it is learning to separate, the sort of spiritual question of someone's capacity for conversion from the policy question of what do you do with them when they have committed a serious offense. And I think that distinction, unpacking that idea, is taking some time. You know, the other bit of just, ecclesiastical psychology, I think, that's relevant here is that in some ways, some of the vices that we're seeing in terms of, moving these abuser priests from assignment to assignment, or writing nice letters for them, trying to get them other jobs, or backing them up when they're in a tough spot. I mean, these are vices that in some cases are born of an excess of virtue. That is that, you have bishops who really are doing everything they can to try to prop up and support struggling members of the clerical club. So far as it goes, it's a noble intention. The problem is that it's a form of tribal morality. And by that I mean the moral rules, this moral concern, applies only to members of the tribe. And once you step outside the clerical world, then the people out there don't count as much. I also think what's going on right now is that leaders of the church, those people who have risen through the ranks of clerical culture, are being forced to redefine, to expand the zone of moral concern to include not just priests, but the whole people of God. And so that the claim the priest has to be supported in his tough moments is now going to have to be balanced against the claim that the people have not to be put in a position where they could be abused by this guy. And so I think there is a learning process that's going on that, to be fair, has begun and in some places has taken root more profoundly than others. But certainly that process is going to have to be accelerated as part of the resolution to this crisis.
You tell a story about Pope John the 23rd that after a difficult day, he said, I'm only the Pope, I'm going to bed. And then you speak of John Paul II in a very different way, you as almost messianic in his own belief about his own actions.
Yeah, well, I mean, this Pope has a very strong sense of election. Usually this comes up in the context. Another question people often ask is this Pope going to resign? And although canon law makes a provision for it, canon 332.2 has a provision for a Pope to resign. I think it's almost incredible that John Paul II is going to exercise it. One, because he said he's not going to. I mean, in 1994, when he had his hip replacement surgery, he told the doctor that you have to heal me and I have to get better because there's no room in the church for an emeritus pope. And again in 95, on the anniversary of his ordination to the priesthood, he said, it's in the hands of God how much longer I continue. But even at a sort of deeper psychological level than that, it's clear this pope believes that he has been put in this position by divine providence, and he's been kept there by divine providence. And the classic case in point is he believes that on May 13th, 1981, when Mehmet Ali Aka shot him in St. Peter's Square, that the Virgin Mary actually altered the flight path of a bullet to keep him in office. If that bullet had gone 6 inches in either direction, it would have punctured a heart or punctured a lung, and he would have been dead. And May 13th happens to be the feast day of Our Lady of Fatima. And on the one-year anniversary of the assassination attempt, the Pope went to Fatima and placed the bullet in the crown of the Virgin of Fatima as a way of thanking her for keeping him in office. So, I think if you believe that that the Virgin Mary and the divine realm is suspending the laws of physics in order to keep you in office, I just don't think you wake up one morning and decide, I'm finished. I mean, this is enough. I'll go into I'll hit the lecture circuit or something like that. It's just not psychologically consistent.
Thank you, John, very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His column is called The Word from Rome. We spoke to him earlier today. This is Fresh Air.